Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a really interesting book that I think has a number of things really to say about the current, where we're at currently, where we might be in the future, kind of a lot of things about how we got here. And we have a fabulous author with us, Dr. Mark Edelman, to tell us about the book titled Peasant Politics of the 21st Century, published by Cornell University Press. And the book, I mean, kind of does what it says, right? Focuses on peasant politics in the last two decades or so to understand what these agrarian movements, what these transnational agrarian movements are doing with rural society, with the world's food and agricultural systems, and really so much more. So, Mark, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Miranda.
I'm delighted to have you. Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I'm a professor of anthropology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center. Those are both campuses of the City University of New York, the largest public urban university in the United States. I thought I would mention briefly the subtitle of the book, Transnational Social Movements and Agrarian Change, because the focus is very much on the transnational social movements of rural people and new forms of solidarity. Reflecting on how I came to write the book, I think there are remote reasons and more proximate ones. I came of age intellectually and politically in the late 1960s and 1970s, when peasants were indisputably major political protagonists in much of the world and important agents of social transformation. The peasant armies of Vietnam defeated the most powerful military machine in history. Peasant guerrillas in Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau kicked the Portuguese colonialists out of Africa. A largely peasant army overthrew the white supremacist regime in what was then Rhodesia and what became Zimbabwe. In Latin America, there were various rural guerrilla movements, mostly demanding redistribution of large underutilized landed estates, haciendas, and dignity for socially excluded sectors of the population. Most of them did not ultimately fare very well, but they were nonetheless very much in the vanguard of an effort to transform society. In the 1970s, I traveled a lot in Latin America and did my first anthropological fieldwork in a mountainous indigenous region of Mexico. So I got to see up close the appalling conditions that the rural poor endured. The more proximate reasons for writing the book, I became involved in studying land tenure and then peasant movements in Costa Rica and Central America. And the Costa Rican peasant movements in the late 1980s and 1990s were branching out and establishing links with similar movements in neighboring countries. Of course, the Central American region is pretty small, and that was not so difficult to do. But eventually, those networks ramified outwards and connected to movements in Europe and India, elsewhere in Asia, eventually Africa. So after several decades of research and writing on transnational agrarian movements and new forms of solidarity, and having gone to sites throughout the Americas, Europe, and South and Southeast Asia, I decided to collect in one volume a number of essays. Some of them were conference papers. Most of them were unpublished. A few had been published in obscure academic journals. And Cornell University Press encouraged me and published Peasant Politics of the 21st Century earlier this year.
Thank you for giving us that background. I think it kind of helps us understand the book and obviously the contextual aspects that go into it. And it's in fact on that kind of last point that I'd love to continue. How did you decide what to include in the book?
Well, I was looking for some thematic unity and some linking threads. So I started with the early history of transnational agrarian movements, which goes back to the late 19th and early 20th centuries. A lot of people think that transnational social movements could only emerge in the age of the internet, but that really isn't true. And if one traces the histories of the agrarian movements back, they connect to first wave feminism, to the Women's Institute movement, which was significant in Canada and the UK and to some extent in the United States, to pacifist and to agrarian populist movements. So I started with those early origins. I moved on to peasant and farmer involvement in the 1999 Seattle protests against the World Trade Organization and its agenda of liberalizing agricultural trade. My research on transnational peasant politics started in the Central American region, so I devoted a section to the rise and fall and then reemergence of agrarian organizations there. Among other things, making a point that I consider important, which is that most social movements don't prosper. Many of them fail, but often the energy that they embodied comes manifest in new efforts and in other kinds of movements. Food sovereignty is a complicated demand that emerged from the Central American and Western European farmer organizations. And I have a somewhat iconoclastic take on food sovereignty that traces its roots not to La Via Campesina, the big transnational peasant organization, as many people claim, but to a Mexican government program and to the grassroots peasants and intellectuals in Central America. I did 8 years of intermittent field work in the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva and in some other places in Honduras and Germany and elsewhere on the struggle that led to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other People Working in Rural Areas, which is abbreviated UN drop. And I had a minor role in the negotiations and drafting process, which I describe in section 4 of Peasant Politics in the 21st Century. The last section, apart from the conclusion, includes a chapter on the pros and cons of engaged research and another on 8 things that land-grabbing researchers need to keep in mind. And among the things that I say they need to keep in mind is the need to make invisible people visible. That is, to foreground peoples who the dominant groups and urbanites rarely see, acknowledge, appreciate, or understand.
A very comprehensive overview of the book. Thank you. As listeners can probably tell, we're going to get into some of those topics, but there's so much to get into that this will be, in many ways, kind of a highlights tour of the book. And listeners are very much encouraged to read the book itself to get all the details. But staying at the big picture level for a moment further, obviously, as you described kind of the range of topics there, but also the amount of time that this research covers, did you have any kind of key reflections or insights as you put this together, either or both in terms of like the actual content, as well as maybe about how research and ethnography is done?
Well, certainly there are a number of reflections on the bigger picture and the conclusion, and I'll mention just a few of them. One is that much social movements research focuses on formally constituted organizations. And there's a lot of politics that occurs outside of formally constituted organizations. There are often people who have been marginalized from those organizations, who don't want to join them, who have been expelled, who have quit. And I found it interesting, as much as possible, to get in touch with those people and to get their views, because otherwise researchers depend a lot on the official spokespeople, on what the web page says, and so on. So that would be one thing. Another thing is that to do research on and with highly politicized people or subjects, one cannot start from a position of neutrality or some kind of dubious positivist objectivity, quote unquote. You don't have to and probably should not blindly sympathize with or be a cheerleader for the people you are studying, but they will demand to know where you stand, and they will do research on you, whether you know it or not and whether you like it or not. And I should say that this research on me occurred in the period when I was starting this research before the internet was widely available in Central America. People were doing research on me to see if I was okay. So you can imagine what it was like as a U.S. citizen to do research in Central America in the late 80s and early 90s when there were civil wars in three countries and the U.S. was a key actor. The personal politics were very, very delicate. One of the things that I argue in the book, and it's really, I think, a key takeaway for scholars who aspire to work in solidarity with social movements, is that the biggest contribution scholars can make to social movements is often to report the testimony of people in the movement's target constituencies who are nonetheless uninterested in, skeptical of, opposed to the movement. Movement leaders usually don't receive that kind of information, and they need it to be effective.
Those are some very helpful insights and takeaways. So thank you for kind of giving us those big picture things to think of as we go through some of the more detailed aspects I'd like to discuss with you from the book, starting with the section that talks about the Seattle protests against the World Trade Organizations that took place in 1999 that you mentioned in your brief overview. The article that's in the book is a reflection 10 years after that. Obviously, it's been a while further since 1999. If you stand in 2024, how do you reflect both on the protests as well as what you thought about the protests 10 years after them?
Well, I think it's important to start with what used to be called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which was the predecessor to the World Trade Organization. And in the last round of GATT negotiations, there was a move by primarily northern developed agricultural exporting countries, but also by some similar countries in the global south, to include agriculture under the purview of what was going to become the WTO. And this move to include agriculture in the Uruguay round of GATT and then in the WTO was the biggest immediate cause of transnational peasant and farmer organizing in the late 1980s and into the 1990s and beyond. Why? Well, WTO and also other so-called free trade agreements, bilateral, multilateral, or whatever, and I say so-called because often they were more investment treaties than actual free trade agreements. These changes in the world economy forced all maize farmers in the world, for example, to compete in a single global market. So how is the peasant producer in Mexico or Malawi or somewhere going to compete with the technologically advanced and highly subsidized large farmer in Iowa or Nebraska? It simply wasn't possible. It wasn't easy, and millions of people gave up and migrated elsewhere, sometimes across borders, sometimes to urban areas in their own countries. So peasants and farmers understood the downside of free trade and of the rich country's agricultural dumping long before other sectors of society and organized against it. Dumping is actually a technical term in international trade lingo that refers to selling products abroad at below the cost of production. Why would anybody do that? Well, often they do it for in an effort to gain market share or sometimes geopolitical advantage. And the United States and the European Union have long been accused by developing countries of engaging in agricultural dumping, particularly of major commodity crops. The other thing that I found interesting in looking at the 1999 Battle of Seattle against the WTO is that there's this narrative out there propagated in part by people who are very enamored of narrow views of identity politics, that the protesters in Seattle were overwhelmingly white North Americans. And it's not entirely wrong, but what that narrative obscures is that there were very significant delegations of people from the global South, of non-white U.S. and Canadian citizens as well. So the crowd is actually more diverse than is usually acknowledged. I document that in the chapter that you mentioned. The other thing that we could think about maybe looking back on WTO, the protesters in 1999 pretty successfully derailed that round of WTO negotiations and stalled the momentum of the economic liberalization process. They did that in part because their arguments appealed to developing country delegates who were very concerned about protecting their farmers and about the agricultural and food crisis that free trade implied. WTO is formally a consensus-based organization. That means that every country has one vote. And this, of course, has slowed down the liberalization agenda of the WTO, which has been stalled for a very long time. And the fact that there are now protectionist forces in the rich countries that are becoming more and more vocal and expressing skepticism about the free trade agenda, I think that that portends a real slowing down and possibly a reversal of the economic liberalization process that WTO is very significantly responsible for.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, what comes through in that chapter is not looking at it as a history lesson, right? Looking at it as very much a continual debate and something to keep an eye on in the future. So I'm pleased that that was in the book. I found it really interesting. But I'd like to ask about another aspect that you talk about in the book. You mentioned earlier the kind of perhaps assumption or myth that transnational agrarian movements or transnational social movements need the internet in order to connect. And you mentioned a little bit about how that's very much not the case. I think there's another myth that you discuss in the book that would be also worth busting a bit. The idea that the leaders of agrarian movements maybe don't have formal education or don't have a kind of impressive list of accomplishments. Can you talk a bit about kind of what the reality might be and also maybe why that myth might be there?
Well, I think in many societies that are culturally primarily urban and where urbanites control the media and much of the public conversation, there's a received image of peasants and farmers as being, take your pick from the long list of pejorative terms in many languages that refer to rural people. And early on in the research in Central America, I met many Central American peasant activists who had really impressive understandings of trade policy and macroeconomics. And sometimes these were people who had only completed fourth grade in their education. What they did have was a very extensive curriculum of courses sponsored by unions, by peasant organizations, by NGOs. And I also spoke to some of the people who were running these courses, and they said, these people are just as smart as we are, and we can give them very high-level materials, and they get it. Part of the reason they got it was because they were living a crisis of maize. which was exacerbated by the U.S. dumping of subsidized corn, which was a staple crop in most of the Central American region. And this glutted local markets, and it wrecked their livelihoods. And they were very clear on this. They understood it very clearly. So the elites often expect peasant activists to conform to some antiquated image of the rural rustic or bumpkin. And some of these people really didn't fit that image. Many, I would say. Some had even gotten university educations. Some had dropped out. Some had completed degrees. And this reflected significant processes of upward mobility in some of the societies and the opening up of public higher education to bright young rural people who took advantage of that and became lawyers and became agronomists and became teachers and all these other things. So there's something that one sees over and over again historically and in contemporary times, that whenever a peasant activist acts educated, the elites charge them with being inauthentic. So this is a very complicated dance that the activists have to engage in order to, on the one hand, prove their authenticity, and on the other hand, to mobilize their full capacity to debate and to make the arguments that they want to make.
What possibilities do you think are opened up if we're more aware of, if we acknowledge more these more nuanced backgrounds rather than the kind of assume the pejorative is true?
Well, one of the things that I found looking, for example, at some of the founding figures in La Via Campesina, which is this big network of peasant organizations, they claim to represent 200 million people worldwide. Whether that number is entirely accurate or not, I think is hard to tell. But in looking at and interviewing and getting to know some of the founding figures, one thing that stood out was that many of them were multilingual. And of course, being multilingual is, in my country, in the United States, somewhat unusual phenomenon for people who are not migrants or the children of migrants. But it isn't that unusual outside of North America and a few other places. Some of these people had lived in exile and had to learn languages in other countries. Some were the children of marriages between people of two different language groups or nationalities. Quite a number of them had lived as migrants in other countries. And as I mentioned a minute ago, some had benefited from society-wide processes of upper mobility and managed to get university educations. So we're not talking about the intellectually or geographically isolated peasants that still inhabit the elite's imagination. And I don't see anything problematical about acknowledging these realities. They actually are important if one is going to understand how it is that people from different language groups and different countries are able to communicate with each other in the beginning. I think, for example, of a Basque farmer who I mentioned in the book with the somewhat unusual name of Paul Nicholson. Well, his father was Scottish and his mother was Basque, and he lived in both places. And he also spoke French. And he was able to serve in the very initial years of organizing of La Via Campesina as a link between the Spanish and Portuguese-speaking Latin American organizations and the French-speaking and English-speaking European organizations. And he's a very key person, very interesting biography and history. I would also say, I mentioned before the UN Declaration on the Rights of Peasants, and during the negotiations for the UN drop, this peasant expertise was very much on display. In the beginning of each negotiation session, there would be a panel and different people would present and speak. And there's one panel where there was a presentation by Jose Esquinas, who is a world famous plant geneticist. And he testified in the negotiations in favor of an expanded right to conserve and exchange peasant seeds. But so did Guy Kastler, a peasant from France who was at least as knowledgeable and had the added advantage of deep knowledge derived from cultivating the earth on his farm. So there was a lot of expertise there that typically is not recognized by the credentialed experts, by the media, by the punditry, by the urban elites in general.
Well, speaking perhaps of the pinnacle of the credentialed elites, or at least that might be their self-perception, can we talk about your involvement with the UN drop effort? How were you involved in these negotiations and drafting processes?
Well, maybe the first thing I should say is that no place has a more exaggerated respect for credentialed expertise than the United Nations. And that was also something that was very easy to see repeatedly in Geneva. The fact that I was a professor somehow was maybe more important than it should have been. The idea of a UN declaration or convention on peasants' rights had been around since about 2001. And it came out of Indonesia primarily in the period following the overthrow of the Suharto dictatorship in the late 90s, and a period that in Indonesia they referred to as reformasi, which was a kind of democratic opening, and people began to talk about human rights. The question of whether it was going to be a non-binding declaration or binding convention was sort of up in the air for a number of years. I became interested in it in the aftermath of the 2008 world financial and food crisis. I intuited that the rapid uptick in the numbers of people facing hunger would create an opening for the idea of defending peasants' rights, since about three quarters of the newly hungry were in rural zones, and many were ironically small-scale food producers. So I first went to Geneva in 2011 with support from the U.S. National Science Foundation, and I went to observe discussions in the Human Rights Council's Advisory Committee. The Advisory Committee is a think tank of experts that makes recommendations to the Council. It's, I think, 17 or 18 experts, sociologists, economists, lawyers, and so on. And at some point, I had arranged an interview with the Bolivian ambassador. This is a few years later. Bolivia was managing the negotiations in the council. And I went over to her several hours before just to confirm that we were meeting. And I think she was talking to one of her staff at that moment. Because they were speaking in Spanish, I just joined in Spanish. And that somehow opened something up in our relation. And that afternoon, I ended up having a very long joint interview with the ambassador, Angelica Navarro, a really impressive diplomat with a master's from LSE, I think in environmental science, who spoke three UN languages flawlessly. She spoke English, Spanish, and French, which is something that makes it much easier to be a diplomat in that context. The Bolivian vice foreign minister also happened to be in Geneva then and was also part of the conversation. And we hit it off, as sometimes occurs in interviews, in a very nice way. And I think they considered me de confianza, trustworthy, and possibly a kind of resource person. So at the first formal negotiating session in 2013, they called these working groups, intergovernmental working groups. And the Office of the High Commissioner invited me to present a briefing paper on the definition of the rights holders, that is the peasants, since most international legal instruments have a definition of the rights holders in Article 1. And it was the Office of the High Commissioner that formally invited me, but I think behind the scenes, it was the Bolivians and possibly FIAN International, which is an NGO that was very involved in the process, may have put my name forward. But in any case, I was asked to present a briefing paper on the definition of peasants to the to the Human Rights Council. And that paper is chapter 9 of Peasant Politics of the 21st Century. And it's probably the key thing to read if you're still wondering what a peasant is, because that's not a simple thing that's easily operationalized. And later that year, the council asked that Navarro and the Bolivians redraft the entire declaration to make it more consistent with accepted language and international law. The draft that they were working with had been written by La Vía Campesina. It had been tweaked a bit by the advisory committee of the Human Rights Council, and it still had language in it that set off alarm bells, particularly in the European Union and the United States. For example, it referred to the right to reject outside interference in our territories and the right to set the prices for what we produce. And this kind of language was seen as an attack on market economics and overly radical. So the idea was that this had to come out. A lot of UN negotiations involve trading words that some states find objectionable for other language that they find less objectionable. So the ambassador invited a half dozen people who were familiar with the issues to assist in the redrafting process. And they tasked me with drafting the articles on rights holders and on cultural rights, since I was like the only anthropologist in the room. And English was a language of negotiation. And I mentioned that because there were only two native English speakers in the group. So I had to do a lot of proofreading also. And I was consulted about things like, what is the difference between persons and people? Because the European Union for a while insisted on using the word persons instead of people, at the encouragement of the UK, I'm fairly sure. And the idea was that persons implies a group of individuals, and only individuals can be rights holders. And people had a somewhat collectivist odor about it, and they objected to that. So there were issues of language that came up in that process too.
Which I found absolutely fascinating. So thank you for explaining some of the examples here as well. Before I get into kind of asking you about the big picture outcome of all these negotiations, I wonder if we can poke at something you've mentioned already a little bit further. Not so much asking you to kind of in a nutshell define peasant, obviously that's done properly in the book, but more, what was it like to define and explain what peasant was in this kind of credential-focused environment of the UN Human Rights Council?
Well, the setting of the Human Rights Council, it's this large chamber in the Palais des Nations in Geneva, and it has a kind of peculiar multicolored stucco ceiling. You can, I'm sure, find pictures of this online. And I saw it as a tremendous opportunity to address an audience that typically one doesn't get to address, namely diplomats, social movements, peasants, and other people from all over the world, from rural areas. And one of the things that I had to address very quickly is that the term peasant, and remember that the whole negotiation is in English, even though people could speak in any other UN language. And occasionally there'd be people speaking in non-UN languages who would bring their own interpreters, Koreans, for example. But in English, the term peasant often has a negative valence. Although its rough equivalents in other languages tend to be more descriptive and neutral. A word like campesino or paysan in Spanish or French really means just people from the countryside. But because English was a language of negotiation for UN drop, and the draft texts weren't even translated to other UN languages until near the end of the process, it was important that the delegations understand the historical and contemporary uses of the term, and particularly why so many rural activists around the world employ it as a term of self-ascription. They say very proudly, we are peasants, we are campesinos, we are paysans. One problem was that the supposedly equivalent terms in other languages, campesino, paysan, etc., aren't entirely coterminous with peasant. They simply mean people of the land, people of the countryside, sometimes whether or not they're mainly agriculturalists. And the negative connotations of peasant was a problem in the negotiations because the British, in particular, ridiculed the term. The UK was still in the EU for most of the negotiations, and the EU frequently voted as a bloc, although towards the end, that began to break down a little bit. So the Brits, invoking their native command of English, tried to persuade EU diplomats from non-Anglophone countries that the term peasant was an anachronism and inappropriate. And at one point, I even asked a lower-level British delegate if the UK stance had anything to do with England being the first country to abolish or destroy its peasantry and the famous enclosures of the 17th century and after. And he was uncharacteristically tongue-tied, or maybe just being a cagey diplomat, and he thanked me for giving him something to reflect on.
Very interesting. Thank you for telling us more about that. I could ask you so much more about UN drop, but I suppose before we move on from it, could you maybe finish that section with a brief comment on kind of what you think some of the most significant aspects of it are?
Sure. I think the most exciting thing about the UN drop negotiations was that the rights holders, the peasants, played a major role in negotiating an international law that applied to them, that protected them. The only other time that this really happened was with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. To some extent, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women had a lot of input from women's organizations, too. But in the case of UN drop, organizations of rural women, fishers, pastoralists, and indigenous peoples were also involved, especially in the later negotiating sessions. And as chair of the negotiations, Bolivia did something very unprecedented and interesting, which was to open up the process so that social movements and not just NGOs with UN accreditation, with ECOSOC accreditation, could participate in the negotiations. The peasants, fishers, and others talked about their experiences, their understandings, their hopes. They didn't want to be fumigated with toxic pesticides, for example. They opposed industrial fishing because it destroyed marine environments and their livelihoods. These big trawlers that come off the coast of West Africa and elsewhere and scoop up all of the fish. They didn't want women rural workers exposed to sexual violence and predation in the fields. And there were many times I saw that diplomats were shocked by the eloquence and the erudition of the peasant activists. Another important thing is, as I point out in Chapter 8 of Peasant Politics in the 21st Century, even the draft UN drop became a standard in legal cases on several continents. This is remarkable because it wasn't international law yet, and in any case, it was non-binding soft law, like all UN declarations are. The draft text was also a standard that agrarian organizations in Colombia brought to the negotiations for the peace accords between the government and the FARC guerrillas in 2016, ended that country's 50-year-long civil conflict. So even before it was adopted by the General Assembly in 2018, it was having an impact and was viewed as a legal standard. since UNDROP's adoption by the General Assembly in 2018, has continued to figure in the Colombian debate over the inclusion of campesinos as political subjects in the Constitution. And this is very near, I think, to realization at this point. I was in Colombia a couple of weeks ago, and people are talking as if this is going to happen very soon.
Is there anything further you'd like to say on that?
Well, there have been a number of other cases. There was a case in Honduras where there was a seed law passed that was very favorable to multinational seed laws, and the Honduran Supreme Court just in the past month or two overturned that law, invoking a number of international agreements to which Honduras was a signatory, including the UN Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and Other Rural People.
Very interesting to understand kind of how this was developed and what the impacts are already having and how it continues to be something it sounds like we can look to very much in the future. Given kind of the current state and as well looking ahead, you spoke a bit earlier about kind of what role academics can have in supporting transnational social movements. Is there anything further you think academics, researchers, people like that listening to this should think about, should reflect on in terms of kind of what they can do going forward, what they should do going forward, working with or researching on rural social movements?
Well, maybe the first thing, which I point out in Peasant Politics of the 21st Century, is that the distinction between social movement activists and researchers is rather artificial. Activists do research constantly, and often it's very rigorous and thorough research. And maybe the organization that best exemplifies this, in my opinion, is the Canadian National Farmers Union, which has a very brilliant research team. The relation between academics like me and social movement activists is sometimes a bit delicate. It has to strive for horizontality, even though it is shot through with hierarchies. So the goals of the two groups of academics and activists sometimes overlap, but they don't coincide entirely. So the terms and the boundaries of any collaboration have to be discussed explicitly and agreed on. And in some ways, that sounds very intimidating for the new researcher starting a project. But in my experience, it's easier than it sounds if there is mutual respect. And if the academic's presentation of self is genuine and consistent in different contexts, because as I mentioned before, people do research on us and they really want to know who we are and why we're asking all of these pesky questions. In Peasant Politics, I mentioned how goals may diverge around the publication of research results, let's say in the form of a book. Movement activists in a collaborative relationship with a researcher might prefer a publication venue that has wide distribution, a progressive publisher, and a low price, and they want results quickly. And we academics tend to seek prestigious university presses and to take our time finishing research and writing things up. And the presses take a long time to review what we write too. So it's a very long process. And sometimes we publish first in a language that isn't a language spoken in the area of the research. And some academics never publish anything in the language of the area. So I view that as very problematical. But I think the point is that there's no good solution that will completely satisfy all parties to the relationship. I quote a Nicaraguan activist in the book, Sinforiano Cáceres, who remarked to me, he said, "Sometimes we feel like cows. The researchers come and give us a big milking and someone else gets to drink the milk." So the goal is to move beyond that kind of extractive model towards something that, however lopsidedly, serves both parties.
I think that's a very important takeaway from the book and from this impressive body of research. Are there any other, perhaps, lessons you think people can take away from the book, perhaps less in terms of research methods and more about kind of what 21st century politics is doing, looks like, given where we're at in 2024?
Well, peasants and small farmers spearheaded the largest protest movements in the early 21st century, bar none. We must take them seriously. In the book, I mention Ecuador, where there have been major societal upheavals sparked by peasant activism. India, where the largest protests ever in human history have occurred in the past couple of years against the Modi government's effort to impose a further liberalization of Indian agriculture, to take away support prices and so on. So these are huge movements in contemporary times, and we have to take them seriously. Another thing that is important to emphasize is that peasants and small farmers are knowledge producers and sometimes offer compelling alternatives for resolving the most pressing global issues, including the long-term sustainability of our food production systems and resolving the climate catastrophe. Because industrial agriculture is eating the natural capital of the earth, and it's not replacing it. And peasant agriculture takes a different approach in most cases, not in every case, to long-term sustainability. So we need to begin to look at the knowledge that is generated in these somewhat unconventional places. The other thing that it's very important to acknowledge is that peasant and small farmer voices are at a considerable disadvantage considering the power of corporate agribusiness and the industrial ag lobbies and their allied philanthropies, such as the Gates Foundation. It's a grossly unequal contest. But it's also the case that peasants have always managed to survive despite all the neoliberal economists, land grabbers, and giant commodities brokers that surround them. They're a class of very tenacious survivors. And at some point, and I think early on in the book, I quote the Dutch sociologist John de Vanderploeg, who points out that there are now more peasants in the world, allowing, of course, for some flexibility in how you define that, than ever before in human history. How many urbanites anywhere in Europe or North America realize that?
Some very good points to take away. Thank you for those, in many ways, concluding thoughts in our discussion. I do have one final question, though. The book obviously has, as you mentioned, just come out earlier in the year and is a collection of things that hadn't been published before and things you've been working on for a while. Now that it's out, is there anything you might be working on or looking to work on that you'd like to preview?
At some point, while this book was still in process, really beginning in 2016, I suppose, I became very concerned with the rise of authoritarian populist demagogic leaders around the world. Trump, obviously, in my own country, but also Erdogan in Turkey, Modi in India, Putin, Duterte in the Philippines, Orban in Hungary, Bolsonaro, and others. And I was involved in two collaborative projects that were very meaningful, and I'd like to think had some minor impacts. One was a collaborative effort to examine the role of authoritarian populism, its roots in rural areas, its impact in rural areas worldwide. And this grew into a network of a couple hundred people. And the other focused more narrowly on the United States, led me to write a couple of years ago a Connecting the Dots piece about how capitalism decimated rural and small town communities in the United States. And I should maybe mention it, even though I'm a professor at the City University of New York, I've been living for the past 4+ years in rural zones. And in writing about the United States, I have to acknowledge that the framing idea for the analysis derived from a comment that I heard many years ago from a Canadian farmer activist, and that I quote in Peasant Politics of the 21st Century. Roy Atkinson, a founder of the Canadian National Farmers Union, which is a La Via Campesina member organization, asked me what I noticed about the towns in rural Saskatchewan that were thriving and those that were dying. Because in the Canadian prairies, as in upstate New York, where I now live, there are towns that are half abandoned. There are others that are doing well. The ones that were thriving, Atkinson pointed out to me, all had a cooperative grain elevator and a credit union. So these were ways that communities could produce wealth and circulate it in their immediate regions rather than having it sucked out by giant corporations and financial actors located in faraway cities, as has happened in much of the rural United States. So I'm continuing to focus on that in general terms. Most immediately, I've been asked to write something about what some people see as a fascist threat in my country. And I've been sketching out an analysis that points to the way, to a key difference between fascist politicians and authoritarian populists, which is that the latter claim legitimacy based on elections, however corrupt or problematical these may be. And Trump, in contrast, is a wannabe fascist who treats electoral processes as inconvenient obstacles to staying in or returning to power. And at the same time, there's research recently that I didn't do, but that I've been reading, that shows that Americans no longer understand the term fascist. It's not 1945 anymore, when virtually every young adult male in the United States was a veteran of World War II. Many Americans today incorrectly locate fascism on the political left. And Trump and various right-wing pundits have taken to calling Biden a fascist. So I'm searching for some new language to discuss what's really a new variant of an old kind of barbarism.
Well, those sound like a bunch of very important and interesting projects. So thank you for the preview. Best of luck with them. If they become books, who knows, maybe we can have you back. But in the meantime, of course, listeners can read the book we've primarily been discussing, titled, as you've said, Peasant Politics of the 21st Century, published by Cornell University Press. Mark, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda. It's been a pleasure.